Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama promised he'd respond to a cyber attack on Sony Pictures. Today, he did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Friday, January 2nd, and it's great to have you with us. There were already sanctions against North Korea. Now there are even more. The Obama administration decided to respond to what it calls the provocative, destabilizing, and repressive actions and policies of the government of North Korea, including its destructive, coercive, cyber-related actions during November and December 2014. That's the hack the country allegedly perpetrated against Sony Pictures. Joining us now to talk about that story and a few other big ones from the past week is Neela Richardson, chief economist at Redfin. Happy New Year, Neela. Good to see you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Well, let me ask you what you make of this attack, first of all, and sort of how the response has been. This is an administration that has relied on economic sanctions quite a bit, whether it's Russia and now North Korea.
Well, it's an economics-centered attack, and it had a reciprocal economic sanction. And the question that it begs is, do sanctions work, especially for a country that's already having extensive sanctions from the U.S.? Sanctions have had a mixed record globally. There's no indication that this is going to work much better than the sanctions that are already in place. But I think it shows you the trend now of countries attacking each other through the financial system or through companies and then retaliating in kind.
This is the first step. The White House says there could be other measures it takes against North Korea. I wanted to ask you about Europe. I gather that I can get a euro for $1.20 now. I mean, the value of the euro is so low. The focus over the last year, this is a good time to sort of look back and look forward. There's been a lot of trouble in the eurozone. Do you think that 2015 is going to be any better? It doesn't seem like the signs are that it might be.
You know, I'm an optimist, so I always think that the next year is going to be a little bit better than where we came from. But yeah, there's some significant problems facing Europe, facing Asia. And you have to wonder whether that's going to bleed back into the United States. We've actually seen a pickup. But this global demand is going to affect our balance sheet just as much as it affects the rest of the world. So that is still an X factor for 2015.
You spent a lot of time looking at housing. I wanted to ask you about the housing market. Last year was a bit better, but not, you know, a tremendous year, I gather, for housing. What's your take on how it was and how do you think it's going to be going forward?
Well, you know, it was normal. We didn't get the big sales that we did in 2013. We didn't have all the investors. We didn't have the price surges. What we saw is a market that was trying to be boring. It didn't quite pull it off, but it was trying to be more normal than it has been in the past. So in 2015, there's still some unknowns, but we think it's going to be a continual improvement, but not very sexy.
Is it a buyer's market, a seller's market? Has that changed at all?
It's changing some places. What we're seeing is that buyers are saying, hey, this price is too high and I'm not going to pay it. And that's a big shift from 2013. They were willing to pay whatever the seller wanted to list at. Now buyers are taking a breath. They're stopping and they're saying, is this house actually worth that much money? And I regard that as a normal market development. Prices shouldn't go up and up forever.
A little bit of perspective is a good thing. Let me ask you about jobs. The White House had a series of monthly employment reports that were pretty good, that it could be pretty proud of. How does its focus shift in light of that, now that the rate is down to where it is, now that we've had this series of good numbers? Does it now focus on, say, wage growth getting wages up? What's its focus going to be?
If it's not focused on wage growth, it should refocus on wage growth, because that's been the problem. That's been stuck in the mud for the last several years since the crisis. And 40% or more of those jobs that were created were in the low wage sector. And we're seeing state by state, starting yesterday, that they voted to increase the minimum wage. The states have gotten the message. Now it's going to be whether the government follows in kind. So far, we're still waiting to hear something about that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, I think there's been some excitement about that, particularly on the part of the White House, that, you know, there's momentum toward that happening at a federal level. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think it's going to make a big difference if that wage in some states goes up by, you know, a few cents, you know, to maybe even more than a dollar?
Well, a few cents, it's probably not going to make a lot of difference for some people. But, you know, where we've seen some more significant wage increases, it would put money in the back pocket. But there are actually more efficient ways to help people who are just at the poverty line. And that's what I'd like to see both parties kind of address, like the earned income tax credit, to bolster these wages in a way that significantly helps families. And we haven't seen that yet.
We didn't get to that, but our fingers are crossed that Congress does a bit more than it has done over these last few years. Neela Richardson, chief economist with Redfin, with me here in D.C. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
On today, the first trading day of 2015, not a whole lot of action. Details when we do the numbers. Yesterday, the Ohio State Buckeyes and the Oregon Ducks each won their respective bowl games. They'll advance to the first college football national championship determined by playoffs, not polls. Athletic departments are happy about the change and the windfall of cash that comes with it, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
$7.3 billion. That's the sum ESPN will pay for 12-year broadcast rights to the four major bowl games, plus the two semifinal bowls and the national championship game. Since it draws championship interest to three games instead of just one, the money-making potential here is huge. Many say it's only a matter of time before the bracket is expanded to eight teams or more.
I do believe that this will be the first step in an expansion to what would likely be a eight-team playoff eventually.
Paul Swengard is the director of the University of Oregon's Sports Marketing Center. As the TV money keeps growing, he says program budgets and coaching salaries are increasingly on par with the pros. The only ones who aren't seeing a payday are the players. Ryan Van Bergen is a former defensive lineman for the University of Michigan.
The more it's similar to the NFL, the more it looks like it's supposed to function as a business, and you're going to see players react and expect to be compensated as if it's a business.
As popular as the playoff format is, Van Bergen thinks expanding it to more teams and possibly more games would be a big mistake.
Adding a game's not going to improve anyone's education. It's only going to create another potential for some of these kids to get hurt.
Conceivably, there are ways college players could get value out of an expanded playoff. Ken Shropshire teaches at Penn's Wharton School of Business.
Use those dollars to improve the educational opportunities, to improve the post-playing day opportunities for these student-athletes.
Shropshire says things like additional stipends or possibly a lifetime education credit could spread some of the money around and partially preserve the image of the student-athlete. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Grocery stores get by on razor-thin profit margins, coupled with how much meat and produce and milk prices fluctuate. It's a tough business, but some of the biggest names in tech have gotten into the grocery game. Why? Sally Herships reports.
When you think of Amazon, what do you think of? I think of microphone cables, socks, and vacuum cleaner filters. Those are all things I've ordered recently. But now Amazon has a new service, Amazon Fresh. It's delivering groceries. So I ordered some to try it out, and the delivery came right on time.
Raspberries. Some squishage?
Let's assess.
Looks like you lost about a third of them to being squished as they were rolling around in the box.
My roommate, Carolyn Lenski, helped me unpack the groceries.
Like literally a third? No, they don't look that bad. You think?
Well, yeah, they're not destroyed, but they don't belong on the top of a bakery cake.
For the record, Carolyn is a chef. The raspberries seemed fine to me. But why does Amazon want to deliver merchandise that could get squished or leak or go bad? Didn't some companies like Webvan and Cosmo already try this and fail miserably?
Yeah, the question is, why would anyone in the right mind doing this? There's the carcass of multi-billion-dollar companies on the side of the road here.
Scott Galloway teaches marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. He says the answer is simple.
Well, grocery is the largest consumer category in the world.
And?
It's this unique combination of being the biggest consumer category in the world and also the most digitally inept, which all spells opportunity.
Something Fresh Direct figured out a while ago. Think about it. Does your local grocery store have a shopping app? Newcomers are moving in to let consumers shop online and get groceries delivered. Instacart and hybrids like Boxed.com, which delivers bulk, non-perishable items. Even Uber is selling lunch. And you can now find sriracha sauce at Bed Bath & Beyond. Google has a new service, Google Express, which offers same-day delivery. I wanted to try it out, but they do not deliver to Brooklyn. Okay, so that's 0 points for Google Express. Since Google wouldn't come to me, I went to it, the company's offices in New York. How would you, I just want to get a sense of like the scope.
We sell scope too.
Mike Pezzicola is with Google Express.
Along with breakfast snacks, we sell breakfast, you know, post-breakfast needs such as toothbrushes and toothpaste and scope.
Pezzicola says, for now, Google delivers only non-perishable items.
Everyone wants milk delivered with their cookies, and we're not quite there yet. We have nothing to announce today, but we're still working on it.
Wait a second. Google's delivering cookies? You know, aside from the digital kind, Google has an entire online mall where you can shop at stores like Target, Fairway, and Barnes & Noble. Lori DeMeritt is CEO of the Hartman Group, a research and consulting firm for the food and beverage industry. She says she has big questions about the future of online shopping for fresh groceries, tomatoes, parsley, onions.
There is still something about being able to see that fruit, to see those cuts of meat, to be able to pick your prepared foods by yourself.
Instead, she says the types of products we want delivered are commodity goods, the kind that are the same no matter where you buy them.
So it would be a branded box of cereal, a branded can of beans, things where consumers don't necessarily think that different retailers are going to have different products.
But a lot of companies, like Amazon, want all your business. NYU's Scott Galloway again.
Amazon isn't looking to be the leader in a certain sector in retail. They're looking to own retail full stop.
For some companies, big or small, food represents the final retail frontier. But consumers may be focused on something different. Unlike when you go to the grocery store yourself, delivery isn't always free. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Take a moment now to remember Mario Cuomo. The three-term governor of New York died yesterday at the age of 82. At the 1984 Democratic National Convention, Cuomo delivered a populist stemwinder on income inequality. He took issue with President Ronald Reagan's assertion that America's destiny was to be a shining city on a hill.
Mr. President, you ought to know that this nation is more a tale of two cities than it is just a shining city on a hill.
That's a speech poet Robert Pinsky remembers well, emblematic of a certain period in our democracy that prized eloquence. According to Pinsky, Cuomo had the ability to make the truth logically convincing and moving.
It was partly numbers, and it was understanding how to make numbers comprehensible and forceful that was so powerful in that speech.
Politicians from both parties could learn from the way Cuomo talked and talked about economic inequality. Bill Clinton, who speaks in what's called the plain style. John Edwards, whose stump speech was about the two Americas.
I'm not just talking about the difference between the rich and the poor. I'm talking about the very rich and everybody else. That's the two Americas.
President George W. Bush talked about compassionate conservatism.
It is compassionate to actively help our fellow citizens in need. It is conservative to insist on responsibility and on results.
Today we hear populist rhetoric from the likes of Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren and her Republican colleague, Rand Paul. Mario Cuomo spoke at Yale in 1985. We campaign in poetry, he said, but when we're elected, we're forced to govern in prose. Coming up,
Vinoid was this ugly troll-like character clad in a red onesie with rabbit ears and buck teeth.
From marketing genius to PR disaster. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 9 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 17,832. The NASDAQ fell 9 points, 0.2%, to end the day at 4,726. And the S&P 500 fell less than 1 point, barely changed, to finish at 2058. For the week, the Dow closed down 1.2%. The S&P 500 was off 1.5%, and the NASDAQ dipped 1.7%. Lynn Energy rose 12%. It said it cut its oil and natural gas budget by 53% for the new year, becoming the latest energy company to reduce its drilling budget on the slide in oil prices. Europe's markets fell. Germany's DAX dropped 0.4%. Britain's FTSE retreated 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.11%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Have you seen a lot of new cars on the road lately? The Motor Vehicle Sales Index for the month of December will let us know just how many. On this day in 1933, construction began on the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California. The bridge was completed 4.5 years later. And thank God it's Monday? While you're stuck in traffic, just remember there are only 51 Mondays left in 2015. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Many of Silicon Valley's biggest players say they've been trying hard to diversify their workforces. Google, Apple, Yahoo, and Facebook have been pouring resources into talent development programs and also into workshops aimed at curbing what's called implicit bias. Tech companies are learning from another sector that was also dominated by white men just a decade ago, but has made some big strides since. Orchestras. The BBC's Nick Bryant visits New York to learn about blind auditioning.
The fruity sound of the tenor trombone in the accomplished hands of Weston Sprott. Straight out of music college, this young African-American managed to get a chair in one of the world's great ensembles, the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra in New York. He's a beneficiary of blind auditioning, a process designed to eliminate any form of discrimination.
Basically, what happens is you walk in the room, the committee, which is behind a large screen so they can't see who you are, has determined from the extensive list they gave you a couple of months ago a handful of things they want to hear you play. Each person that participates in the audition is simply assigned a number, and the people who are behind the committee only are aware of you in the context of what number you are. So their decision is based solely on your merit, what they hear.
The Met goes to great lengths to make sure the process is blind. Carpet is laid down so the committee can't determine whether it's the footsteps of a man or a woman entering the room. The orchestra's manager is Robert Cernick.
Somebody has a prejudice towards a young person, towards an old person, towards a heavy person, towards a blind person. Any sort of prejudice is leveled.
When I joined the London Symphony Orchestra as a player, it was an all-male orchestra, in fact, and I was absolutely a central part of the board when we fought to change that and ensure that women could join and that we were 100% fair on that.
Clive Gillinson was once with the LSO and is now the artistic director at Carnegie Hall. Blind auditioning is flawed, he says, because successful players still have to undertake trials with the orchestra where their identity is revealed.
However much you do blind auditions, if people actually have prejudice, then when you have the trial in the orchestra, and you have to have a trial in the orchestra, they're still going to eliminate somebody if prejudice actually exists. The way we used to do it at the LSO, to be fair, is we made sure we had a woman on the audition panel. We always had breadth of people on the panel so that one was absolutely looking after the fact that there could be no prejudice of any sort within the discussion.
But Weston Sprott swears by the process, which one study showed increased the probability of women advancing through the early audition rounds by a staggering 50%.
You've got an orchestra that looks like New York, but is also one of the finest ensembles in the world.
That's true. I think that's what happens when you base employment on actual quality and merit. And I think it also builds a mutual respect amongst our colleagues because everyone is aware that we all got to the position that we're in through the same process. We all got there because we deserve to be there and because we earned it from behind a screen, free of bias.
The BBC's Nick Bryant. Publication Adweek just released its list of the 13 biggest marketing blunders of 2014. A Subway ad telling women to eat better so they look sexier in Halloween costumes. That came in at number 12. McDonald's' new, slightly terrifying Happy Meal mascot. Well, that was number 6. And topping the list was Apple's $100 million gift of U2's new album Songs of Innocence to iTunes users, whether they wanted it or not. All of these could be considered bad ideas right out of the gate, but sometimes a campaign can take a drastic turn after years of success. Zachary Crockett is a writer for the blog Priceonomics, and he has the story of Domino's Pizza and the fall of its strangely beloved mascot.
From its inception, Domino's was kind of a quirky chain. They were founded with $900 by two brothers in 1960. And by the late 70s, they'd evolved into this $500 million enterprise. A large factor of their success was this 30-minute or less guarantee that they had.
Taste the quality.
Which was basically a promise to their customers that if they didn't receive their pizza in 30 minutes or less, they'd get it for free.
One call does it all.
In the 80s, they decided they needed kind of a visual manifestation of this policy. The result of that was the Noid.
This is the Noid. He loves to ruin your pizza.
The Noid was this ugly, troll-like character clad in a red onesie with rabbit ears and buck teeth.
The Noid did it.
In the commercials, Domino's would portray him as this creature intent on destroying every pizza that went through the production line. Soon, they developed the slogan, Avoid the Noid.
Avoid the Noid!
And they claimed that their pizzas were immune to this creature. The Noid was strange in that there was this utter detestment for him, but everyone also seemed to love him at the same time. In 1989, the Noid kind of took off on another level. These plush toys were created, and video games were made, and really, the Noid became a household name. Then, right at the peak of his popularity, he endured probably the worst mascot PR in history. On January 30th, 1989, this man wielding a .357 Magnum walks into a Domino's in Atlanta, Georgia, and he holds two employees hostage. The police arrive, and it becomes a huge ordeal. It ends up being a five-hour standoff. He's demanding money, he's demanding a getaway car. He even forces these employees to make him pizzas. Finally, he is distracted for a moment, and these hostages escape. The police apprehend him, and he's charged with this slew of felonies. It turns out the reason this man was agitated is because he was a paranoid schizophrenic named Kenneth Lamar Noid. He had this ongoing feud in his mind with the owner of Domino's. He believed that this marketing campaign was directed at him. The media had a field day. Really, it just became a running joke.
Now a report on new Domino's Pan Pizza.
In one newspaper in Boca Raton, the headline was, Domino's hostages couldn't avoid the Noid this time. Though the media made this event out to be quirky and funny, it did have kind of a sad, depressing side to it. Lamar Noid was found innocent by reason of insanity, and he spent 3 months in a Georgia mental institution. In 1995, he actually ended up committing suicide. He was never really able to shake the idea that this entire campaign had been
a smear against him. Subsequently, Domino's terminated the Noid. He completely disappeared from all of their marketing campaigns. He had sunken into obscurity. In 2011, the Noid actually made a short-lived return for his 25th anniversary. Domino's brought him back for this promotional Facebook game. It was somewhat inappropriately named the Noid Super Pizza Shootout.
That's Zachary Crockett of the blog Priceonomics. We have a link to his original story up on our website. That's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the ride-sharing service Uber raises prices when demand goes up. The company calls this surge pricing, and in the run-up to New Year's Eve, there was a lot of speculation about when that would happen, how close to midnight, and by how much Uber's prices would go up. Well, the company spent the last couple of days crunching data on what Uber says was the busiest night of the year. More than 100,000 people were in an Uber at the stroke of midnight, and demand increased by 180% between a minute after midnight and 12:30 in the morning. New Yorkers took the most trips around 2 a.m. Parisians took the most trips around 4 their time. And most of those trips subject to Uber's surge pricing, they happened between 12:30 and 2:30. And that's it. That's Marketplace for this, the second day in January. Today, the Dow advanced 9 points, less than a 0.1%. The NASDAQ fell 9 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 fell less than 1 point, barely changed. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. It's produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Kai, we'll be back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.